Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to the Above Politics Show. I'm Homer Fife.
And I'm Martin Bain, and I'm not going to crow or sort of be big-headed about this one, but a certain number three U.S. automaker went Chapter 11. Now, I wonder who predicted that at our end-of-year show in 2008.
I'm telling you, it's getting spooky the way you're getting with these predictions, because you were spot on with this one.
I certainly was. I know I did, how should we say, flex a little bit because there were some rumors that GM might go under, but I'm glad I sort of implicitly kept the faith. And yeah, it's quite interesting that, you know, not a surprise, I don't think, to many people that Chrysler have gone under. But I think what is even more interesting is that, you know, Chrysler was desperately trying to talk to its financiers and creditors, and some of the hedge funds were sort of being greedy here, which, you know, I sort of suspect isn't probably going to leave the best impression in the sort of, you know, automotive heartland of the state, that, you know, this company's now in Chapter 11 and because some financiers and bankers were greedy.
I think so, because, you know, the government offered them a buyout at 29 cents on the dollar and they turned it down. You know, and 29 cents on the dollar for $6.9 billion, I thought that was a good deal.
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, whether, you know, President Barack Obama is actually going to be able to do anything here other than just sort of some platitudes and some good words here to say, you know, we're going to do everything possible to support Chrysler. But, you know, it seems that the banks and the financial business and the hedge funds are just doing what they've always done. Well, if we can't get our buck, we'll put you under because they think they might get more money from it.
They need to leave this one alone, Martin. They need to find out exactly what we've talked about since all of this debacle began. If they leave this alone and let the market take care of this, okay, so Chrysler files Chapter 11, big deal. You're going to get some people that are going to lose their jobs, and the entire company is not going to fold. Okay, the market's going to take care of this. They're going to have to restructure. They need to become competitive. If they're not going to be competitive, then the government doesn't need to step in and bail these people out. And that's what we've talked about before. It's ridiculous that the government is sinking money into these corporations that refuse to become competitive in the world market. And you know what? I'm sorry, but Toyota, Honda, Nissan, if they're offering a better product, then they need to be more successful. And that's just the way it works.
And, you know, and I think from a sort of free marketeer point of view, you can accept that. But I think it's very hard for any country to potentially see, you know, one of the cornerstones of its manufacturing industry just taken out like that. You know, the UK desperately tried hard to save Rover. You know, in France, Peugeot Citroën gets a lot of support from the government. You know, and automotive typically has always seen as, you know, a flagstone, cornerstone, and then, you know, how many millions of Americans and even, you know, probably hundreds of thousands and even millions of other people across the world are employed purely because of the big three automakers. You know, in the US, how many people are employed by the automakers? It's millions of people. So you can see why the government would have to say we can't afford to let this go under naturally.
Yeah, but now listen to this. I just want to read one little excerpt from the Fox News article on this. The new Chrysler, and this is a quote, the new Chrysler is a four-headed mutant partially owned by two governments. The United States owns 8%, Canada 2%. It will be run by the Italian automaker, Fiat, and Fiat's going to pour its fuel-efficient technology, yak, yak, yak. However, the entire thing, the sales, are going to be financed by General Motors, which we talked about last show, where General Motors has a whole bunch of money still in its hedge funds that can be used for such things. This is just getting ridiculous. It's absolutely getting ridiculous. Just let the market handle it and let it go.
Well, yeah, but we know that's actually not going to happen. I think Fiat is an interesting partner for Chrysler to go with. I mean, Fiat typically have had a reputation for building small, fuel-efficient, fuel-economical cars. You know, and you only have to look at the Chrysler range to sort of think, well, yeah, fuel economy isn't something that figures in the Chrysler range that much. Yeah, and obviously Americans didn't want to go out and buy, you know, Jeeps, didn't want to go out and buy Dodges, didn't want to go out and buy the other cars in the range, the Crossfires and all those type of things. So, yeah, I suspect, as I've said, Barack Obama had no choice here. I think he had to intervene because so many jobs are on the line here, and it's probably not good for a Democrat to be seen to be letting millions of American workers go on the scrap heap because he wasn't prepared to spend some money.
Well, you know, and I agree with you in theory, but you know what? Obama's going to have to take it on the chin with this one, because I really think that this has gone so far and is so far into the bankruptcy filing that there's just not a whole lot that can be done. What Obama's offering is the taxpayers are going to pony up, what is it, $3.5 billion initially, and then $4.5 billion additionally at the end of all of this. And they're still going to have to go until, because Fiat's not even going to step in here and start doing anything until 2011. So, you know, they've got 3 years where Chrysler's going to have to survive on its own or on the money that's being pushed to them by the taxpayers through this bankruptcy. Because let's face it, Martin, do you think they're going to stop making cars?
Absolutely not. No, they're not. They're still, you know, whatever car that they've got in development now probably isn't going to be a small economical dual fuel thing. It's, you know, it's going to be a, probably an extension of the existing range. If you say, look at the Sebring, there's talk of the 300 or the Magnum. There's a convertible version of that one, but they've typically got, you know, several thousand liter engines inside them. You know, they're all probably, you know, cubic, you know, 300-400 cubic inch engines. You're right. And the other one is, does the American people want to buy a car from a company that's gone Chapter 11? You know, from a sales point of view, if you were walking into a Chrysler dealer today to sign, would you? You'd have probably said, ah, not a chance. I don't know if the company's going to be here next week. How am I going to get parts? How am I going to get support? How am I going to get service? If you're a sales guy at a Chrysler dealership, you're just sort of thinking, all those orders I had ain't going to happen.
And this is such a contrast in terms too. Now, I know that Martin, you being over there, Fiat has a good name over there, but over here, Fiat is traditionally a car that we used to laugh at. You know, this is the
I'd have to say I would say in the past, in the 70s and 80s, Fiat also had a very poor reputation. Certainly in the UK, they were renowned for being rust buckets.
Exactly, and having lawnmower engines, and you know, they couldn't make it up the mountain. You had to get out and push them to get them up the mountain.
But Fiat has listened to what the marketplace was saying, and today, you know, produces cars that aren't regarded as, you know, unreliable and rusty. It's brought out the a new version of the Fiat 500, which is the very small bubble-shaped car, and that's been well received in the marketplace. And if you think of some of the designs of some of their cars, they're actually quite attractive to look at. You know, you could turn around and say that's because of the Italian flair, but I fully accept it that, you know, Fiat had an appalling reputation in the UK, and it's going to be interesting to see whether Americans are going to be prepared to buy into that sort of concept of, you know, fairly radical looking cars, but potentially maybe only, you know, 1 or 2 liters engine size.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be the big question, because traditionally Chrysler's been the company with the huge vehicles. I mean, when you talked about power, you talked about a Dodge truck with a 5.7 Hemi, you know, which is a huge engine that, you know, granted it's a fairly big gas guzzler, even though they have that new thing now where it cuts out most of your cylinders when you're cruising or whatever. I'm not sure how that works, but regardless, you're going from this company that is famous for its powerful, fast, huge engine vehicles down to, like you say, these radical little space-age design cars. And I'm just not sure how well it's going to be received.
Now, I have to express a very personal interest here. I just hope this doesn't do one thing, and that there's supposed to be a Chrysler 300 convertible coming out. And if you're listening, don't can that, guys, because I've been waiting for that since the 300 came out, and I really want to buy one.
Okay, now let's talk for just a minute about some of this mess that's going on over there in your part of the world with Gordon Brown. What's up with that, Martin?
He's having a torrid time being Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. You know, a couple of things have happened this week.
I feel sorry for the guy.
I suspect that could be a fairly minority view as to whether anybody feels sorry for Prime Minister Brown. It's like people saying they feel sorry for Barack Obama. Well, sorry, if you didn't want to take the rough with the smooth, don't take the top job. You know, Gordon has suffered a little bit. He's had two major sort of kicks to the teeth this week. One was over the right of soldiers who had fought for the United Kingdom in the Gurkha regiments to come and live here, and Gordon had sort of said, well, it's too expensive and it's going to bring too many people into the country. Now, for those who don't know, the Gurkhas are a sort of, I suppose in essence you have to think of them slightly as a mercenary regiment, similar to the French Foreign Legion with the French military. But these are Nepalese soldiers who have fought for the British Crown and the British Monarchy and the United Kingdom for many, many years, and have been, you know, involved in sort of campaigns most of last century and almost all the campaigns in this century. And they have a fearsome reputation, and there are stories that, you know, the Japanese and the Germans, you know, didn't really want to fight the Gurkhas because they were, you know, fearsome, ruthless soldiers who would just kill you as soon as look at you. And one of the things that, you know, Gordon Brown said was, well, we can't have all the soldiers who served our country come into the United Kingdom. So he sort of said, we can't do this. And he really wasn't listening to the sentiment of the people or the House of Commons. And there was something called an Opposition Day debate, which is where the opposition can say, we want to take a day and we want to debate something that's important to us. And there was this debate and then a vote on whether Gurkha should be allowed to stay in the United Kingdom, and Gordon Brown lost. And it appears that over 100 of his own MPs either voted with the opposition or did not vote, so that, you know, he was sent a very clear message that the country and the MPs think this is a wrong thing to do. And I think this just comes back to, I think Gordon at the moment is being poorly advised. He's just,
and I'll tell you, you know what might be a problem with this, Martin, is I'm just reading here on the BBC site. It says that 100% open door policy would simply be too expensive. And this is a quote, that they've put the cost at £1.4 billion. Okay, now at the outset, £1.4 billion sounds like a lot of money, but let's face it, Martin, how many billions, how many tens of billions of pounds has the British government put into bailing out banks, bailing out insurance corporations, and now all of a sudden they're crying over $1.4 billion with bringing these freedom fighters who have fought for your country and have shown themselves to be loyal. And I mean, come on. You know, these Gurkha fighters are absolutely deserve the support from your country.
And the worst thing is, if you went out to the, I'm trying to think if there would be people in the United Kingdom who would probably object to this. Yes, there are always going to be some, but if you ask the vast majority of the British people, they would say, if it's okay for us to ask the Gurkhas to shed their blood and give their lives to defend what, you know, our government and our leaders think is important. You're right. There is no justification here. Gordon just took his finger off the pulse, or just did not understand the strength of feeling in the country and even in his own party. And that's what's quite worrying, is you've got a guy here who is, you know, head of the United Kingdom, and I heard an article this morning from David Blunkett and also I think Charles Clark, who were both ministers, past ministers, and they were sort of talking about, well, Gordon's busy, he's looking, you know, he's got a lot of things on the world stage to do. But guess what, Gordon, I expect you to multitask. I expect you to be able to have your finger on the pulse of what's going on globally with the economic crisis, but I also want you to be aware of what the British people are thinking. And it's troubling that he's not getting the right advice, because what other bum decisions is he going to bring up? We've got another one, expenses. You know, he seems to be floundering on this one, and, you know, people are voting against him, and there's I'm trying to think of the best word to describe it, an independent review of MPs' expenses. Well, Gordon Brown seems to be wanting to have votes on this before this report is due. And you just sort of think, you're just not on the ball anymore. And you can see why maybe some Labour Party people are starting to think, wow, is this the man that can actually lead us to the next government? Probably not dissimilar to the way that a lot of Republicans were thinking towards the end of George Bush's term, thinking, well, shall we prepare for government? We've got to be positive here, but let's realistically prepare to be in opposition for 4 to 8 years.
Right. And you know, here you have Downing Street coming out and saying that denies that, that Brown's been damaged by the events. But then, you know, they come out, they bring that statement out in the face of Charles Clarke, just to mention him again, who's actually quoted about saying he was ashamed to be a Labour MP. You know, he's absolutely ashamed of your administration and the way it's running. And, you know, you can't help but look at the parallels here when you've got a President Obama here who when he was criticized about the Tea Parties at the White House, claimed he didn't even know they were happening.
Yeah, and it staggers, you know, it's staggering that these people who are our leaders are so far out of touch with what's going on. And I suppose it is a bubble. You know, people talk about the Westminster bubble, and I'm sure they must talk about the Washington bubble. You know, that it gets so insular that you're probably not having the opportunity to actually sit down with regular people. You know, you and I, would you call us regular? But, you know, a lot of the people who are members on ATS, you know, would Gordon Brown, would Barack Obama sit down and say, actually, guess what? I'm going to clear my diaries and I'm maybe going to, you know, go out somewhere and just talk to some normal people and ask them what's actually worrying them. They don't seem to do that. They seem to use focus groups and spin doctors and analysts to tell them what they're thinking. And like everything, these things go wrong. And that's what Gordon Brown is suffering from right now. And I suspect it's what George Bush suffered from towards the end of his presidency, that they just didn't listen to their instincts and to what the people were actually trying to tell them.
But you know what? You nailed it, because I'm sorry. There is no excuse for that, Martin. It's exactly what you said. I expect my leader to be able to multitask. I expect my leader to be able to go out and find out what the people want. There is no excuse for this. Now, you know, you're talking about study groups. Well, that's fine. But when you have a leader who has a particular political viewpoint, what study groups is he going to listen to? I mean, you just take, for instance, over here, Barack Obama has already decided that global warming is a fact. So now every little bit of our political machinery here is going to be geared toward solving the man-made global warming, when, you know, the science is split 50-50 either way, and no one has been able to tell us if it's real or not. You know, there's been study after study showing that it's just a natural progression of the planet. But, you know, that's the problem, isn't it? What you're talking about is a bubble. I'm talking about is a political ideology that refuses to open their ears and listen to what's going on around them. And I'm sorry, I have no sympathy for them.
And you know, in the UK, we have some elections coming up on the 4th of June for the European Parliament. And I don't think I'm going to be far from the mark that I suspect that the Labour Party is probably going to take a fair bit of a drubbing and lose many of its seats. And clearly that's an opportunity for the British people to turn round and say, hey, Gordon, you're not listening to us. Now, you should, I mean, the whole concept around the United Kingdom is that you vote for the person, not the party. But in reality, a lot of people vote for the party. And, you know, it's going to be a bad day for Gordon Brown on the 5th and 6th of June, when he potentially realises just how bad the losses have been for the Labour Party in the European elections. And I suspect one of the doomsday scenarios for Gordon Brown that he could be facing is that the extreme British party, the British National Party, could actually get an MEP elected this time round. And, you know, I suspect that could start to, you know, really sound the death knell of Gordon Brown having any chance of being elected.
Martin, I'm sorry, but if that's true, if that's true, our show's going to take off like crazy, because if those radicals get in power, that's going to be just, it's just going to be something to sit back and watch. And I'm sorry, because I know the turmoil that it will cause in your country.
But it will be. I mean, it will be very fun. I mean, you know, let's cover this. They're not likely to get into power, but there is the chance that they may get one or more MPs into the European Parliament. And there's some thought that, you know, potentially they may even get an MP into Westminster. But yeah, just to sit back and just see the fun that that will cause. You know, we had in one of the early shows, we had somebody from the British National Party on. We had their press secretary on. But, you know, and other than the most recent show regarding the remarks from the head of Homeland Security, you know, I suspect that was probably one of the more interesting shows that generated a lot of response. But yeah, and this is what makes politics so fun. This is what makes doing this show so fun, that we, that, you know, you and I can sit here and talk about something that may happen and just think, so how are people going to react? And, you know, what happens on the 4th, 5th and 6th of June as the votes are counted, it's going to be interesting. But I suspect Gordon Brown is going to be coming out with some spin that, oh, he's going to listen to the British people and it's not as bad as it seems for the Labour Party. Whereas really what you want to hear is an MP or a leader just come out and say, got that one wrong. We're going to take a couple of days out, guys, and work out what we do. But we won't get that. We'll get spin. We'll get, oh, yeah, we're listening. And you know very well there's a little chance they won't actually listen.
Exactly like the spin we're getting here. And you mentioned this thing with the Department of Homeland Security. You know what? She still got her job. And that's the question that I've got. Now, we've got a thread on this from our last week's show. And the big gaping elephant in the room, as you put it, is I've yet to see a Democrat come on and defend this stuff that she spouted. I mean, or a liberal, let's just say liberal, all right, because, you know, anytime you start calling somebody a Democrat, they always go, I'm not a Democrat. Yes, you are. You know, and that's another thing that's irritating. This Napolitano can get up there and spout her mouth off, and look, I'm not going to get into a rant again, no matter how much it fires me up, but this is a perfect example of what you're talking about. But this is not fun. When you have a member of an administration stand up and insult a huge percentage of the population of the United States, because you know what? The majority of the United States are Christian. You can say what you want, but that's just a fact. Okay, I don't care what anybody believes. That's a fact. So she's come out and said a majority of the United States are people that could be domestic terrorists. She has said that veterans that who have served their country, the ones that are making it so she can spout off these comments, they're possible domestic terrorists, and she's still got her job. So I'm wondering, where are these liberals? Why haven't you stepped up and defended this?
Because it could be. It's undefendable. And sometimes, you know, even I have to say there are things that are undefendable. But the interesting thing is, presumably, her boss, when he took the oath of office, he got a special Bible. I think the same one that, was it George Washington used?
Yeah, I believe it was.
So obviously he put his hand on that one and, you know, swore, you know, on the Bible and in front of God that he was going to do his duty as president. So does that mean that, you know, that Barack Obama is now to be considered as someone who could be a domestic terrorist? Because clearly he swore an oath on the Bible. You'd like to think he believes in the Bible, and taking that oath under the Bible must actually mean something for him. So clearly her boss is clearly a threat.
Now, that is a very interesting take, but we have a little joke around the office. We're about split 50-50 at our office with the people who have served their country and those who haven't. And the ones who didn't serve, we laughingly call them draft dodgers. I mean, people have their own opinions on what they should do and what they shouldn't do in their life. And I'm not here to cast aspersions on anyone for not serving or having served. But we talked off air a little bit about this, the fact that our leaders, it seems more and more now, are getting to, we've got so many people in power and in control like this Napolitano and Obama who haven't served their country. And how is it that they can be critical, those of us who have? Now, there could be some argument that they're serving their country now, but you know what, a politician, come on. I mean, you know, it's been said many times, the only reason people become politicians is when they don't have the ability to be anything else in life.
And that's a persuasive argument. I suppose I might see it slightly differently, to say that I actually think it's probably a good thing for humanity that the crop of leaders coming up have not had the cause or the reason to serve. When you think about a lot of people who potentially were in office, you know, towards the end of the 20s and 30s and potentially, you know, the 40s and 50s and early 60s, they had typically had to serve because of the First World War, because of the Second World War. And I think it's good that, you know, as humanity, that we really haven't had a global conflict that has meant that millions of people have been forced to take sides and serve. So I think that's actually got to be a positive. But I can see that argument that, you know, why would you antagonize your current military and all your veterans by saying they're domestic? They could be considered domestic terrorists.
Yeah, and every day that Obama wakes up and steps back into his office is another, and doesn't tell that Napolitano woman to step down, is another day that he insults every veteran in the United States. And he is supposed to be our commander in chief, and that to me is just the most audacious thing. And I'm calling out right now to everyone listening to the show. Get in touch with your liberal friends, or if you're a liberal and you're listening to the show, get on that thread and comment, defend this a little bit, because you're defending it by your silence. Your silence speaks volumes here, because there is no defense for this. Or if you contact me or Martin, either one, step up. We'll put you on the show. I will be more than happy. I'm sure Martin will be glad to moderate a debate between me and whatever liberal wants to step up and defend this, because I would be glad to take some time. We'll do a special show on it. I don't care what it takes.
Golly, I'm not sure I want to be in the middle of that one, but yes, I will stand in the middle of that one. I have no problems with that one, so you know what to do. And then finally, as we get close to the end of the show, I do have to talk about something that fairly insignificant matter round the world, and Homer's laughing because we've already discussed this. I have to say, I think the swine flu epidemic, you know, is really bad news for the people who have suffered and the people who have suffered death because of that one. And, you know, our thoughts are out to those people. But it does seem to have overtaken the boards a little bit and overtaken all the news programs. And, you know, I just sort of thinking, these things happen. They've happened just after the Second World War. The First World War. They happened, I think, in 57. They happened in 68, 69. It just seems that we've just gone crazy here. And it's all, oh, someone sneezed, they must have swine flu. You know, I've got to say, it's, you know, half of what, I think you and I, different reports, but somewhere between 350,000 and 500,000 people die every year from flu. And all this is a, okay, maybe a more virulent and a more dynamic strain of flu, but the board's just gone crazy. You know, if you go to recent posts, you probably find that half of them are to do with swine flu. There must be other things going on in the world.
Oh, Mexico has effectively shut down. It's basically shut his country down now, because there's been talks of the United States shutting the border down completely and no contact with Mexico or whatsoever, because apparently that's where they're saying this thing originated from. But then, of course, there's other threads on AboveTopSecret.com that are stating that this was a man-made type of virus.
Ah, so we're back to the New World Order conspiracy about reducing the population of the planet. See, that's what I love about our website, AboveTopSecret.com. You can always bring it back to a good conspiracy, and that's half the fun of coming on the boards and just thinking, oh, I wonder where this story's going.
Exactly. And, you know, I had the flu, and Martin, you're aware of that. I had the flu about three or 4 weeks ago, and I was wondering if you were afraid to talk to me because, you know, this thing can be spread, and you know, we're here in the studio and I don't want to give it to you.
But, you know, hey, I've got my mask on and I'll spray some gunk over you. But I just think that it's right to be concerned about anything that could, you know, potentially kill you at the absolute outside. But it's just, we seem to have gone overboard on this one, and I just sort of...
Well, I want to take just a second to Martin and make one little comment. I know that why the reason everyone is so upset is because this H1N1 is actually what it is. Supposedly it will spread between humans, swine, and birds, so it's very virulent. But I think it's interesting to note that as deadly as it was in Mexico, it's been reported to be very mild here in the United States, and I think that shows a huge difference between the overall health of the citizens between the two countries. We are a healthier country. We live healthier, we eat healthier, and you're going to see less death and devastation from something as awesome as the flu here in the United States. Where in Mexico, you have people living right on the ragged edge of poverty, and, you know, a good cold could kill some of those people.
And you sort of have to think, if you, and I know we're coming, we probably overshot time, but hey, who cares? If you sort of take the whole New World conspiracy thing of, well, typically the elite would want to keep people alive who can serve them. So if you sort of take the whole mentality of this is a man-made thing, why would you potentially start that in a country where people are, you know, on the edge of, you know, as you say, on the edge of life to a degree? Surely aren't those the people that the elite are going to want alive so they can subjugate them and do their bidding? So I just think that's a lovely one. So if you're into New World Order conspiracies, find the show thread and come on that one, because that's something that interests me, is that I've seen people say, oh, this is part of the New World Order, and why would you get rid of people that you might want to subjugate who are going to feed you and you want to serve you?
I couldn't agree more, Martin.
So I just think it's great. But anyway, yes, we probably need to wrap the show up, but it's been a fun show. And if you like what we've said, you know what to do. Find the show thread, post away. If you vehemently disagree with either of us, guess what? We're happy to enter in a debate to you. And as Homer said, if you want to come on and defend the comments of the head of Homeland Security, come and find us. But, you know, we've had a ranging show today, from Chrysler going Chapter 11, Gordon Brown, Department of Homeland Security, and swine flu. So I'd like to think you get a lot of value out of the show, and we cross many areas.
Absolutely, Martin. And you know what? I'm still Homer Fife.
And I'm Martin Bain, and we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.